If I can have your attention, let's try to get started. I'm Ed Howard with the Alliance for Health Reform. I want to welcome you to this program on behalf of Senator Blunt, Senator Rockefeller, our board of directors. It's a briefing on the people and programs in place in each state to help consumers understand their health insurance options, help them apply for assistance if they're eligible, and help them enroll. Each of the state marketplaces has these programs. There are more than 4,000 of them in the first open enrollment period. And the Affordable Care Act provides some funding for them. Traditional insurance brokers and agents are part of the picture as well. Now, there were more than 10 million people helped by these navigators and other assisters during that six-month open enrollment period last year and early this year. Today, we're going to look at some of the challenges that were faced by those consumer assistance programs, how they responded to them, and what the outlook is for the next open enrollment period, which begins less than 3 months from now. Our partner and co-sponsor in this briefing, the Kaiser Family Foundation, is the source of a lot of the best and most relied on health policy analysis around. And we're pleased to have co-moderating today's discussion Jennifer Tolbert, who's the director of the State Health Reform Project at the foundation. That's as part of her duties to monitor the implementation of the Affordable Care Act, particularly the efforts to set up insurance exchanges in each state. And you'll hear from Jen in just a moment. I'm going to take care of the logistics up front so we can move right through the discussion with as little discontinuity as possible. If you're tweeting, and we would encourage it, note the hashtag assisters. And if you need to tap into Wi-Fi, there's a sheet on your tables that tells you how to do that, and the credentials are on the screen behind us. There's a lot of important information in your packets, background information on the topic, fuller speaker bios, a one-page materials list that if you crank it up on your computer screen, you can click on. There's going to be a video recording of this briefing available in 2 or 3 days, followed by a transcript, both on our website, allhealth.org, and on the Kaiser Family Foundation website, kff.org. You'll find at our website the speaker's slides, and if you're watching on C-SPAN right now and have access to a computer, you can punch up those slides and the rest of the background materials that the folks in the room have in front of them at allhealth.org. Questions at the appropriate time. There are three ways you can do that. There's a green card in your materials you can write a question on. There are microphones you can use to ask your question in person. And if you want to tweet the question, we will snatch it up from the Twitterverse and bring it forward. So prepare for that, and we'll look forward to your questions. And the final little bit of overhead is that there's a blue evaluation form in your kits that we would very much appreciate your filling out so that we can improve these programs for you in the future and to tailor the topics to your needs as well. We'll turn now to Jennifer Tolbert from the Kaiser Family Foundation. Jen, thanks for being here. Look forward to your presentation, too. Yeah, no, you're fine.
Is it on? Oh, sorry.
There, you got it.
All right, are you going to do introductions or no? Okay.
Why don't you go ahead and do that, and then I'll come back and do the introductions.
You want me to give my presentation?
Sure.
Okay. Great, thanks, Ed, and welcome to everyone, and thanks to our panelists for participating in this briefing today and what I anticipate will be a great discussion about the sisters' programs and the role that they played in during the first open enrollment period and kind of throughout this first year. I am going to provide a very brief overview just to make sure that everyone in the room is oriented to these assister programs and the role that they play and the variety of programs that participated in this first year. So there were a variety of programs that provided consumer assistance and outreach in public education during the first open enrollment period. You've probably all heard about the Navigators. Those were programs that were established by the ACA and are required to participate in all marketplaces. They provide outreach and public education, they help consumers apply for coverage, and they facilitate the selection of QHPs, or qualified health plans, in the marketplaces. Now, in-person assisters played a very similar role to navigators, the difference being that they participated only in state-based marketplaces. And the main distinguishing factor between in-person assisters and navigators is how they were funded. In-person assisters were funded primarily through Section 1311 exchange establishment grants by the states in those state-based marketplaces and in consumer assistance partnership states. Certified application counselors were another group of assister programs. These entities were recognized by the marketplaces, but were not funded directly through the marketplaces. The training and other requirements for the CACs were somewhat less extensive than for navigators and in-person assisters. Primarily, they were not required to do outreach in public education, though many of these programs did. Federally qualified health centers also played a really important role in helping consumers sign up for coverage. Most FQHCs participated as CACs, though some functioned as navigators or IPAs. And then finally, there were two organizations that contracted with CMS to provide supplemental enrollment assistance in select communities in federally facilitated marketplace states and in partnership states through the Federal Enrollment Assistance Program. And as Ed mentioned, through our survey of health insurance marketplace assister programs, we estimate that there were about 4,400 assister programs that were established and participated in the first year of helping people sign up for coverage. I should also note that agents and brokers played an important role in helping consumers apply for coverage and enroll in plans. They were not included in our survey, so I can't actually document their role, but I'll talk in a minute about what they did. Healthcare providers, including FQHCs and hospitals, as well as nonprofit community-based organizations, sponsored the majority of assister programs. Now, this probably isn't surprising because these entities have had a long history of serving low-income and uninsured populations. But importantly, other entities also supported assister programs, including state and local government agencies, primarily local health departments, legal aid organizations, churches, colleges and universities, as well as trade associations. And then we estimate that there was over $350 million in federal funding that was available to support the establishment of these programs during the first year. That funding came primarily through federal navigator funding, as well as the Section 1311 exchange establishment grants, and, as I mentioned, that contract that CMS issued through the Enrollment Assistance Program. In addition, the Health Resources and Services Administration, HRSA, which provided funding to the FQHCs, provided about 44% of the total federal funding. Now, importantly, this only represents federal funding to support these programs. We know that there was a great deal of funding through private foundations and other private organizations, as well as funding that was repurposed from organizations' own budgets to support these assister programs. One of the critical issues that I anticipate we will discuss on the panel is future funding for these assister programs. CMS has issued its funding FOA, funding opportunity announcement for the Navigator program at $60 million this year. That represents $7 million less than was available last year. CMS also has not made a decision on whether it's going to extend its contract with the federal enrollment assistance, with the two entities that participated in the federal enrollment assistance program. States can continue to fund their in-person assister programs with Section 1311 grant funds this year, but beginning next year, they will have to identify other sources of funding for their programs. And I will note that HRSA has indicated they will continue funding FQHCs at the same level for this next open enrollment period. And then finally, as I mentioned, while we couldn't document the role of agents and brokers during this first open enrollment period, we do know that they played an important role in helping consumers sign up for coverage. Agents and brokers have traditionally helped people find and enroll in plans in the individual market, and many registered with the new marketplaces and were able to sell products and help consumers find plans, QHPs, in the marketplaces. And in talking to assisters, I think one area that I hope we discuss today has to do with collaboration between agents and brokers and assisters. And in talking to assisters out in the field, some expressed some wariness of working with brokers because they felt like maybe the missions were a little bit different, in part because the brokers do receive commissions from the insurance companies for the plans that they sell. However, a number of other assisters found collaborating with brokers and agents to be quite useful because of the expertise that brokers have with understanding the health plan choices available to consumers. So with that introduction and overview, I'll turn it back to Ed.
Thanks, Jen. And let me just very briefly introduce our panel, nowhere near what they deserve. We're going to start with Karen Politz, a senior fellow at the Kaiser Family Foundation, who's one of the country's leading experts in how consumers fare with their health insurance, and she'll be sharing with us the results of the Kaiser Family Foundation's survey of the marketplace assisters that Jen was referring to. Then we're going to hear from two speakers who are working directly to help those who are trying to figure out whether and how to use the marketplaces to get the best coverage for themselves. Jody Ray is the director of Florida Covering Kids at the Child Center at the University of South Florida. She's won a host of awards for her work enrolling kids and their families into health care coverage. Lisa Stein is the vice president of work and family supports at SeedCo, a nonprofit that helps enroll people into coverage in several states, some with state-based exchanges, some with the federally facilitated ones, and she's going to describe how Navigators and other assisters operate in those different environments. And then finally, we'll hear from Jessica Waltman, who's a senior vice president at the National Association of Health Underwriters, NAHU. Jessica's been with NAHU for 15 years or so, and is going to give us the important perspective of the more than 100,000 brokers and agents that are affiliated with the association and who are, as Jen noted, deeply involved in most of the activities involved in getting people enrolled and signed up for coverage. So without further overhead, Karen Politz, could you take us through the findings of the survey and how that looks to you from your years of experience in this field?
Sure thing. Thank you, Ed. And good afternoon, everyone. And thanks to the Alliance for hosting this briefing today. I will just take a few minutes to summarize some of the key findings of our Foundation Survey of Health Insurance Marketplace Assisters. We fielded this survey just as open enrollment was concluding this spring to learn more about the assister programs, their experiences, and the kinds of help that consumers sought. To do this, we asked CMS and all of the state-based marketplaces to provide us contact information for the directors of their assister programs who were certified to work in the exchanges. And as Jen mentioned, due to some technical difficulties, we couldn't survey the brokers this year, but we hope to be able to do that in the future. Our first finding of this online survey were the numbers, which Ed has mentioned. We learned that there were 4,445 assister programs that were established in the marketplaces across the United States for the first open enrollment period. They employed 28,000 full-time equivalent staff and volunteers, so even more people than that because not all worked full-time. And we estimate 10.6 million consumers sought help from these assister programs during the first open enrollment period. Many who sought help ended up enrolling in qualified health plans, most of those with subsidies. Many enrolled in Medicaid and CHIP. And some people didn't enroll in anything at all. For example, if they lived in states that didn't expand Medicaid eligibility, and then they went to an assister program and found out they were not eligible for any financial help to obtain coverage. I'm going to show you again this slide that Jen showed you just to briefly point out that the marketplaces are required under the ACA to set up navigator programs for reasons that Jen explained. There wasn't money to set up navigator programs per se, so these workarounds got established. This slide shows you that only about 30% of the assister programs that were established in the first year were actually funded by the marketplace or with marketplace implementation funds. The other programs, these volunteer CACs and the FQHC assister programs that were funded by HRSA, comprised most of the programs in the first year and helped most of the people during the first open enrollment. It'll be interesting to see if that changes in the coming year. And it's not moving. Did I do something wrong? There it goes. Assistance was unevenly distributed across types of marketplaces, not surprisingly, because CMS had very limited implementation funds to support navigators in the 29 federal marketplace states, while the state-run and partnership marketplace states could apply for these unlimited exchange establishment grant funds. As a result, there were about twice as many assisters relative to the uninsured population in state and partnership marketplaces compared to the federally run marketplace states. And the number of people helped relative to the uninsured population was about half that in federal marketplace states compared to state-based marketplaces in the first year. These assister programs were busy. For the entire open enrollment period, one in four programs said they could serve most of the people who sought help but had to turn some away, while 12% of programs said that they were swamped most of the time. At the end of open enrollment, remember, half of all people who signed up during the last month. Half of the assister programs said that they had to turn at least some people away. So no Maytag repairmen waiting for the phone to ring. There we go. Providing enrollment assistance was a time-intensive activity. Two-thirds of the programs reported that they spent on average 1 to 2 hours per person setting up an account, going through the ID proofing process, entering the income and the household information necessary to apply for subsidies, reviewing the plan choices, and picking a plan. So why did people go to these navigators and other assister programs? Overwhelmingly, it was because they just didn't know where to begin. Far more than website glitches or busy signals when you called the call center, the assister programs report that people sought help because they do not understand the ACA, what they're supposed to do. They don't understand health insurance. They needed help walking through their plan choices and understanding them, and they simply lacked confidence to apply on their own. Interestingly, 41% of assister programs told us that most to nearly all of their clients who sought help lacked internet access. So in-person help will probably continue to be very important for years to come. After that, programs tell us that it was the details of the application process that prompted people to seek help. Remember, to apply for subsidies, you have to report information about your income and who's in your household, not now, but what you expect that to be in the coming year. Also, what you expect your tax filing status to be in the coming year. And for millions of people, this was not an easy thing to do. They really needed help walking through that. So these reasons, I think, shed some light also on why it took, on average, 1 to 2 hours to walk people through the application process. Ed, where should I point this? There we go. About 90% of programs told us that most to nearly all of the people who sought help were uninsured. And about 3/4 of programs told us that most to nearly all of the people who sought help had significant insurance literacy problems. They needed help understanding basic insurance terms like deductible. This is likely another reason why the assistance process was time intensive. Along with basic insurance literacy problems, assister programs tell us that plan information provided to consumers on the marketplace websites sometimes didn't answer all the questions that consumers had. 40% of programs tell us that this was often or almost always the case. Our survey asked assister programs what they did when this happened. Some of them developed partnerships with insurance brokers, which they report worked very well. And programs also tell us that they hope in the coming years, marketplaces will provide better plan information, more accurate information, better plan comparison tools. And some also think that insurers should be required, as a condition of offering coverage on the marketplace, to provide briefings for the assister programs on the products that they're offering and to provide a dedicated customer service line for the assister programs. One other noteworthy finding, just briefly, had to do with how these programs coordinated with each other. Most of them didn't. But 45% said they did coordinate with other assister programs in their region, and that this helped them work more effectively and efficiently. Some programs used a central scheduling system so that consumers could be directed to a program that had available appointments instead of queuing up at one that was overbooked. And they could also help each other solve complex cases. In some states, kind of a super navigator emerged. I think Jody was one of those, that helped provide technical assistance to other programs. We asked programs who initiated this coordination. Most often, this was something the assisters did on their own, or maybe that was facilitated by an outside third party like a foundation. It'll be interesting to see if marketplaces act proactively to help programs coordinate more in the future. One other important observation, marketplace assister programs are there to get people into coverage, to do outreach and enroll them. But even 1 week after open enrollment closed, most programs, 90% of programs, told us clients were already coming back with post-enrollment questions and problems. They didn't understand how to use their coverage. They couldn't find a doctor who was in network. They'd had a claim denied, and they didn't know how to appeal. The ACA does provide for state ombudsman programs, also called CAPS, to provide a full range of consumer assistance, including help with these kinds of post-enrollment problems. And the CAPS are supposed to serve everybody in a state, not just people who buy through the marketplace. But those CAP programs were last funded in 2012. So now the marketplace assisters are being asked to pick up some of the slack. Finally, just one word about the learning curve. 70% of the programs that helped consumers in the first open enrollment had prior experience before this year. Mostly they had prior insurance enrolling people in Medicaid and CHIP. Only about 16% of programs in the first year report that they had previously helped consumers evaluate private health plan choices and enroll in private coverage. And less than 10% had prior experience with tax issues. So this first year represented a steep learning curve for the assister programs as well as for consumers. The good news is most assistance programs say that it is very likely they will continue in this role for another year. That experience will surely help programs to work more effectively and efficiently. And it will be especially important because millions more people are expected to sign up for coverage in the second year at the same time that the folks who signed up last year are coming back to re-enroll. And, of course, the second open enrollment period will only be half as long, so this will be lots of fun. And I will stop there and turn it back to Jody or Ed.
Jody is fine.
Okay. But I don't know how to do that thing.
You don't have to.
Okay.
Yes, you're queued up now.
Okay. I think I have my mic on, too. So as you already know, in Florida, we participated as part of the federally funded marketplace, and so we had navigators. So University of South Florida was awarded a grant to provide navigator services. We covered 64 of 67 counties. So we needed to look at what our coverage options were going to be. We want our navigators on the ground to be ready to not only enroll folks in the marketplace, but they had to be able to be in a position of connecting them to any available coverage options, which included things like Medicaid and CHIP, and in some cases, we did have some county health plans. But we were faced with, obviously, a significant gap because we didn't expand Medicaid. So we were able to make a concerted effort to identify where resources were in each of the service areas that we're working in. So those that didn't qualify for coverage were still directly connected to services that they may be in need of, even if they weren't able to obtain coverage. So this is what our outreach effort looked like geographically. Like I said, it's covered 64, 67 counties. The only counties we didn't have this year were Broward, Miami-Dade, and Monroe, which is the Keys. We broke the state up into geographic regions, and we designed our outreach initiative to be from the ground up, the grassroots. Instead of the University of South Florida sending in troops to each of these areas, we worked with a consortium of partners in each of the areas. We had about 100 navigators on the ground. We had about 208 project volunteers, and each of these folks reached within their own community to identify a coalition of partners to enhance the efforts they were putting together in the community. One, it was intended to be reflective of the community. So the outreach efforts were comprised by the community, reflective of the community, and they knew who their target populations were. Some of the challenges that we knew we had to be able to address, particularly with the structure that we put into place, was the fact that, A, Florida is a very large state. Pensacola and Key West, they're demographically and geographically very different. And although this time around we didn't go as far as Key West, we were in counties like Palm Beach County. So we had to be cognizant of the fact that effectiveness had to be address the geography that we have in the state. They're also demographically very diverse. Florida, obviously, we had to be able to reach out to hard-to-reach populations in each of the geographic areas. And you have to build a certain level of trust. You have to build public support for directing people to the health coverage. And so the way that we did that was the design of the outreach initiative being that it broke down into the state into regions. We had a very large uninsured population, so our target was pretty significant. And among those that are uninsured, we see a huge deficit in their understanding of what having health insurance means. We're still seeing it because post-enrollment, we're addressing questions around how do I use my health insurance? Do I, now that I have a card, go to a hospital to get my care? So, the most basic of questions are now being answered in follow-up to the open enrollment period so that we can provide a certain level of health literacy to the consumers that now have health insurance so that they can use it appropriately. We also had large swaths of rural areas. Transportation is a significant issue. So our outreach efforts had to include a lot of mobile navigators. This couldn't just be by design someone sitting in an office waiting for folks to come to them. We had to go to where the uninsured were. We had to be convenient in terms of hours and physical location so that they could connect to the consumer assistance they needed. We were also dealing with trust issues among hard-to-reach populations, and because they are so wide in terms of their diversity, we had to make sure that we were working with the right trusted stakeholders within each of those communities who could speak the language, who understood the cultural issues when we're communicating about something like healthcare coverage. In addition to, obviously, the lack of coverage opportunities, which I've already addressed in the previous slide, among amongst the lowest income populations. So while we had lots of people coming in, there were always those that fell in those lowest income range that couldn't obtain coverage under this effort. A key element of the outreach efforts that we put into place under this initiative was also, engaging community partners. They weren't only there to provide navigator services. Community partners played a significant role in referring folks to enrollment assistance. So part of the navigator duties centered around the education and outreach component, and as well as the consumer enrollment assistance piece. So it was real important that our navigator initiative took into account that we needed to engage the larger community, even those that weren't providing navigator services, so that we were ensuring that populations were getting directed to the right places for navigators, that the community knew where the navigators were, who the navigators were, and so building those referral networks and those community partners was real important. We utilized networks and partners that we had spent 16 years building doing outreach for Medicaid and CHIP for children. So it was to our advantage to be able to take those community coalitions and collaborations and say, you know, we've been enrolling these children over all these years, and now we can go back and we can enroll the parents too. And up until recently, we haven't been able to do that. So it was a real advantage for us to go back to those existing networks and those existing partnerships, looking at how we can expand them to reach some of the newly eligible populations. And we were able to get this up and running pretty quick. So here are some of the outcomes of the grant to date. We've been able to assist through the outreach and education events and the one-on-one navigator appointments, over 78,000 individuals. We've attended over 2,500 outreach events throughout the state. We've held more than 17,000 navigator appointments. And of course, those appointments include things like not only doing the application and setting up accounts, but then they come back and then they want to pick a plan and enroll. And so there's that doesn't always happen, you know, with every consumer in that order, but consumer appointments include all of those activities. We had almost 100 navigators trained at any given time throughout the state. Those navigators not only completed the 20 hours of training that HHS required, but in Florida, they were also required to be fingerprinted, background checked, and registered with the state. And so those 100 navigators covered the 64 counties that were our target region. We were able to assist consumers in a wide range of languages. The top five languages obviously are here, which include English, Spanish, and Creole, which is not atypical for Florida, but in addition, we had languages like Arabic, Chinese, and so many more that we had to address. And we utilized not only folks who spoke the languages and were part of the communities, but we also made sure that we always had access to translator services. And obviously, reaching folks through media was real important to be able to get the message out to large numbers of folks around the state. You know, the outreach efforts are one thing. The one-on-one assistance help you get a lot of information and into a consumer and help them through the process. But we really needed to get the message out that, A, that this program was available. They needed to know things like deadlines. And we found that that was one of the most effective ways to do it in some of these larger areas particularly. Again, this just gives you a picture of the outcomes of the work that the Navigator Initiative under University of South Florida was able to achieve during the open enrollment period to date. And we were able to reach more than 200,000 consumers throughout the state. That's it.
There you go.
Thank you.
All right, thanks very much, Jody. We're going to turn now to Lisa Stein.
Can folks hear me? Great. Good afternoon. It's a pleasure to be here with you all today. CECO had the honor of serving as a navigator entity in four states. We worked in Maryland and New York, which were state-based exchange states, who also chose to expand Medicaid. And we also worked in Georgia and Tennessee, which were federally funded exchange states that did not choose to expand Medicaid. I'd like to take a minute and just thank the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, the Maryland Health Benefit Exchange, and the New York State Health Benefit Exchange. They've been great partners and supporters of our work, and we've been honored to be part of this exciting piece of history. So CECO is a national nonprofit organization which advances economic opportunity for people, communities, and businesses in need. We are based in New York City and have offices also in Maryland, Georgia, and Tennessee. We have three program area focus: workforce, work and family supports, and technical assistance. Similar to the slide that Karen shared, our relevant experience prior to open enrollment was CHIP contracts in all four of our states. We currently hold SNAP contracts in all four states where we operate. And in New York, we participated in the facilitated enrollment program with helping people to enroll in Medicaid. In addition, this last statistic... Sorry about that. This last bullet on this slide is a result of our signature tool, Earn Benefits Online, also known as EBO. EBO is a web-based multiple benefit screening tool. With it, trained staff can assist individuals to access multiple benefits in one sitting. They can determine eligibility, populate application forms, and provide individuals with checklists and resources to greatly facilitate their enrollment into benefits. So as a result, from 2005 up until the beginning of open enrollment, CECO and our network have assisted over 180,000 households to receive over $300 million worth of benefits. So in all four states, we are both navigator-funded and as also a certified application counselor sponsoring entity. We chose to use an intermediary model. We work with community partners who have strong affinity group relationships, such as to the LGBT population, immigrant populations, young invincibles. And I'd like to take this moment to say we had very excellent partners in all four of our states, and we are very grateful to them, and they're too numerous for me to mention here today. I'll highlight a few, though. In New York, we worked with a group called COPO that serves the Southeast Muslim population. In Maryland, we worked very closely with two local county health departments. In Georgia, we worked with a partnership between the Health Initiative and Georgia Equality, which focuses on LGBT communities. We also worked with Boat People SOS. And in Tennessee, we partnered with the Appalachian Mountain Project and Easter Seals. I think similar to Karen's slides earlier, you can see from my slide the differences in terms of resources available in each state. For example, in Maryland, statewide, there were 306 funded navigators and assisters, and in Georgia, there were 32 funded navigators. The variance in resources is really at the heart of my next two slides, because the resources really dictated our strategy for deployment of the navigators. So in New York City, where we were concentrated in the five boroughs and with an emphasis on Brooklyn, it was a lot of one-to-one appointments. And as my colleague Jody indicated, that's not just sitting in an office waiting for people to come to you, but going out to points in the community, not just health sites, but workforce sites, food banks, churches, libraries. In Georgia and Tennessee, because there were far fewer resources and much more geographic distribution to cover, we sort of took the show on the road. We would go to regional centers and partner with medical centers or libraries, a lot of church co-sponsored events, and we would bring a group of navigators to the people and do large-scale enrollment events. The resources also dictated education and outreach. In the state-based exchange states of Maryland and New York, there were extensive advertising campaigns well in advance of open enrollment. TV ads, radio ads, every subway, every bus, something in your electric bill, consumers typically had much more awareness of the marketplace and had much more positive association and messaging. In Georgia and Tennessee, because they were federally funded exchange states, it was a big part of the Navigator role to provide that education and outreach. So the most extensive opportunity for the public to hear something positive and to learn something about the marketplace was through earned media. And in both Georgia and Tennessee, we were successful in getting over a million media hits, and those stories would then be reviewed on the internet. People were really hungry for the information. So we sort of had our own lab. We had state-based exchanges, we had federally funded exchanges, we had rural territory, we had urban territory, we had geographic concentrations, we were statewide. So CECO really took the opportunity to take advantage of that, and we contracted with the University of Georgia Center for Health and Risk Communication, and they conducted an evaluation of all of our programs in all four states. This included evaluation of the data we were allowed to collect in each state. They interviewed navigators in each state, and they interviewed consumers who had been served by our navigators in each state. The three bullets on this slide are some key findings that are starting to come out from that research and are focused on the navigator interaction. There was generally a low awareness of navigators. People had heard about the marketplace, had heard about the ACA, but were not as aware that there was free and unbiased assistance available. Consumers really appreciated that assistance. Oftentimes, navigators were the only human face or interaction that someone might encounter as they enrolled into an insurance product. And finally, that the interaction between navigators and consumers could overcome negative preconception. A lot of individuals that came to us had had negative ideas or beliefs regarding healthcare, regarding the marketplace, and felt much more positive and engaged and said that they would go out and tell somebody about their interaction. So there were some challenges. This isn't earth-shocking news. There were some technology issues. In all four states, there were some amount of technical difficulty with either the online portal or the call center. However, in New York and Maryland, which were the state-based exchange portals, navigators and assisters had back-end access into the portal so they could see what was happening with an application and really make sure to assist a consumer all the way through enrollment. And furthermore, they had direct contact and regular contact, sometimes daily, with the state exchange leadership so that they could really communicate real-time information about cases and get real-time results back. HHS was operating a federal portal and call center for 34 states. It was a huge task. And there was no special back-end access for the navigators into the portal, and there was no special back-end access into the call center. Our primary lines of communication were through our grant officers and regional offices, and they were terrific and they were responsive, but the information had to kind of travel through different levels to finally get to the folks who were working the exchanges and working the call centers. Number two challenge that my colleagues have also talked about is low health literacy. The complexity of choosing a health plan is the greatest challenge a navigator faces. All navigators in all four of our states, both state-based exchanges and federal exchanges, received some combination of training that was required. But CECO really felt committed that our navigators needed more, and we provided additional training on health literacy communication techniques, both in advance of open enrollment and continually through an open enrollment, as well as additional one-on-one training regarding complex cases such as immigration status and verifying household income. Finally, the challenge was around privacy concern. CECO has a history of maintaining privacy standards, and we were very committed to meeting the challenge in this new healthcare marketplace in all four of our states. We conducted site visits with our partners to make sure that they were maintaining strict HIPAA protocols. We observed navigators one-to-one in their interactions with consumers. We observed navigators presenting in group interactions and had a very strict policy around making sure we were providing quality services to consumers. We had some really great successes, similar to my colleague from Florida, fast implementation. While Maryland was an early implementer and we began the process in April, with the three other states, we had about 10 or 11 weeks working with multiple partners to get staff hired, trained, certified, and ready to go. In Georgia and Tennessee, there were additional state requirements in addition to the federal requirements that made that a little lengthier, but we did it. And our partners were great, and we are looking forward to doing it again next year, this year. Two, I think a really great success was our community relationships. We chose diverse partners that achieved the required geographic and affinity group diversity. In our experience, word of mouth is the most effective outreach strategy. It quickly establishes trust to begin the enrollment process. Results from our research study, all states demonstrated effective outreach and enrollment to culturally and linguistically diverse populations. Finally, I think our infrastructure was really successful. CECO's model allowed for local flexibility to respond on the ground, and at the same time, national coordination allowed us to share best practices and do course correction as needed. Looking ahead, similar to what Karen indicated, open enrollment is 50% shorter this year and only overlaps with 4 weeks of the free tax preparation season. This is a really strategically strong opportunity to reach people. They come prepared with their financial information, and this will be the first year that folks will understand and face the tax implication of making a choice or not making a choice. However, we've just finished a strategic planning process with all four of our teams, and we're working really hard to ensure we can take advantage of every day of the next open enrollment. QHP renewal process will be the new first in this open enrollment. There's some uncertainty in regards to the online portal functionality as well as communications with consumers. But in the end, this is also a tremendous opportunity to benefit from lessons learned from last year in forums such as today. As I indicated before, we also conducted this study, and we look forward to disseminating that information publicly in September. Thank you.
Great, thanks. Jessica?
Thank you. Good afternoon. I'm Jessica Waltman, and I'm here on behalf of the National Association of Health Underwriters. NAHU represents about 100,000 health insurance agents and brokers from all around the United States. Independent agents have been helping people get covered and stay covered through both private coverage programs and then also a wide range of public assistance programs for over 100 years. Our members serve everyone from individual people accessing the marketplace to also people, employer-based plans, Fortune 100 companies. They own or they work for their own independent businesses, not the health insurance plans. And using an agent doesn't cost a consumer any extra money. In fact, the law requires that consumers be charged the exact same amount regardless of what assistance they use. But instead of receiving grants to help consumers like the other organizations, if an agent enrolls someone in an exchange plan, his or her identifying number, which we call the National Producer Number, or NPN, should be recorded. And then the agent's paid a small monthly pass-through fee that goes through the life of the policy by the health insurance carrier. So remember that because it's going to come back again. Okay. Again, health insurance agents have been around for decades, so they do know a lot of information about plans, like Karen and it indicated previously, that might not be publicly available. You know, things like which plans have good cost controls, or, you know, I have asthma, which plan in the marketplace has the best disease management plan for asthma, things like that. And they're also good with helping with claims problems. Their business model's a little different than all the other assister models, too, because they've been around for a long time. They don't just sign you up. Their goal is to provide year-round service. So they help you when your insurance card never shows up, when you need authorization for a surgery, you get a wacky bill at some point during the year that you don't understand. And then next year, this coming up year, when you need to renew, they're there to help you make sure that your health plan still fits your needs. And enroll you again. And the good news is that there is really no limitation from the law on how many different types of assistance that you use. And agents and brokers can work in concert with other types of assisters. The law intended this. But we do have some public policy suggestions, either regulatory or legislative, that could make this a little bit easier to facilitate those partnerships for consumers. And I think it would also benefit the brokers and the other consumer and assister groups in the year ahead. And I'll get to those in a second. Just a little more background about agents and brokers. Because they have been around for so long, they're very highly regulated. All kinds of state and federal privacy and data security laws apply to them, and they may not apply necessarily to the other groups because they weren't around when those laws were passed. And in addition to any exchange certification, and all the exchanges require broker certification, they also have to be licensed in every state that they do business. They have to complete an additional course of continuing education each year, usually about 24 hours a year annually, and they hold malpractice insurance, which they call errors and omission insurance. They are all legally and financially accountable for the advice that they give. They have to answer to their state insurance commissioners, amongst others, and all the commissioners that I know will tell you that they have people that work for them that have handcuffs. So last year, or really this year, agents were very excited about participating and helping people with exchange-based coverage. As Karen indicated, the survey data that they presented today doesn't really give a complete source of how many agents and brokers were certified, but we've kind of cobbled together a couple different sources, and we estimate that it was about 100,000 agents and brokers were working nationwide to help people with exchange coverage. Not all exchanges collected or have published their data about how many exchange consumers used an agent, but we do point to one, which was a recent Urban Institute study that showed about half of all people that used exchanges did use some type of in-person assistance, including agents and brokers, and that of all those assister groups, agents and brokers had the highest customer satisfaction rate of 83.9%. So, just like everyone, agents did have a few bumps in the road last year with open enrollment. And one of those big bumps really had to do with the agent's identifying number. For a variety of reasons, often those numbers weren't included in exchange records. And to make a long story short, agents and brokers and their consumers didn't really have a good way to fix that. And that created a payment problem for the brokers, but also created a liability problem, because if their number wasn't recorded, then that could affect their malpractice insurance. And then it's also a consumer protection issue, because we think every interaction a consumer has with any type of assister should be recorded. And then finally, it was a big problem for partnerships between agents and brokers and other type of assister groups, particularly in the federal exchange and a few of the state exchanges, because there was only spot to record one number. So if they worked together, somebody's number wasn't being recorded. So we really think that that should be corrected for the year ahead. Agents could also better serve consumers if they had a back-end portal on the federal exchange for year-round case management. That's how non-exchange coverage works in all states now, and then most state exchanges, and we think the federal marketplace really would be helpful if they could catch up. Also, there was no complete list of certified agents and brokers on the healthcare.gov website, which would be an important tool for consumers to have access to, and also for other assister groups to partner with agents and brokers. And we have long called for a good way to report and follow up with client problems in the exchange, such as a hotline. And then we'd also like to see some technical improvements made to the plan, direct enrollment, and web broker mechanisms for independent agents and brokers that would help agents support their clients throughout the year. And a lot of those issues are specific to the federal marketplace. Most of the state exchanges were a little bit more nimble and had better broker resources, but even the best exchanges for brokers did have a few problems, a lot of times around those identifying numbers. The good news is that we do think that broker participation in the exchange next year will be high. We don't really know how it's going to be, but anecdotally we're getting good feedback, and recertification is ongoing right now. It looks like it might be a little bit lower than last year, perhaps due to the bumps that agents had along the road, but overall it's looking good, and we see high participation rates again. So we do have some solutions to help agents and then also other assisters better help consumers in the year ahead. I'd like to point out that Senator Mary Landrieu and a number of her colleagues have introduced two bills that would require HHS to address most of these concerns, and they're Senate Bill 2175 and then also Senate Bill 2173. Additionally, there's a bipartisan coalition of more than 75 House members that have formally called on HHS to fix these issues on the regulatory front, and many other senators and House members have also called on the White House and HHS to up these items on the priority lists on a separate basis. So looking ahead, we do see some great opportunities for 2015. The Federal Shop Exchange will be online soon, and it appears that it will contain many of the broker services that the individual exchange on the federal level does not currently have available and may not have available for the open enrollment season ahead. But we're hopeful for the Shop Exchange that we'll at least have some of that functionality. We also see new market entrants and new products being put onto the market, which will help better meet the needs of our clients, and we'll be able to learn lessons from open enrollment previously. Some concerns that we do see, and I'd love to discuss in the question and answer period, because I know I'm running out of time, include the new re-enrollment process for existing clients. In particular, we really just want to make sure that all exchange enrollees do have ample time to really review their new options for the plan year ahead and just aren't redirected into the same plan from last year if that's not necessarily the most appropriate for them anymore. So we want them to be able to check out their choices. And then also, we do have ongoing concerns about subsidy determinations and making sure that they're accurate for all applicants, particularly those that are being redirected into policies from last year, because many of them may have been offered employer coverage or will be offered employer coverage in the year ahead because of the employer responsibility requirements. And so getting that coverage offer for the first time can affect your subsidy eligibility substantially or negate that subsidy eligibility. So those are some challenges that I see. So thank you very much, and I start with the Q&A.
Great. Thanks very much, Jessica. And let's start with something that you actually raised. I should say, let me remind you, you can tweet a question, you can voice a question, you can write a question. So you have your options, and I would urge you to get involved in the conversation and also encourage our panelists to offer comments back and forth if something that you've heard has raised a question or made you want to make an observation. But you were talking about re-enrollment, Jessica, and the challenges that it raises. And I just wanted to get your reaction and those of the other panelists as well. I mean, we have some number, whether it's 8 million or 6 million or 10 million of people who have signed up for something and are going to have to sign up for something else. Or renew in what they have. We have a prediction that there will be even more people who will be attempting to enroll this open season as compared to last. What does that say about the workload of navigators, assisters, brokers, and what kind of difficulties can we anticipate and maybe try to ameliorate?
Well, from the agents and brokers' perspective, of course, there's always going to be some people that their plan option from last year still is a good fit, and it's important to have an easy way for them to get back and renew that coverage. But we believe that your health insurance purchasing decision is one of the most important, profound decisions a family can make. It has significant financial security implications and also health security implications, and we think that every year you should take a look and make sure that it still fits, particularly with the new subsidy eligibility, to make sure that it's still the right choice for you, it's still affordable, and just check out the marketplace and see if there's new entrants out there that might be a better fit.
Karen?
I think we didn't ask this exact question in our survey when we asked how long it takes to help people. We didn't ask via sister programs to then chunk that up and say how much of that time was involved in actually doing the ID proofing, establishing an account, determining your eligibility for subsidies, and how much of it was plan choice. So I don't know the answer to that question nationwide. I did spend a little bit of time in open enrollment observing a program in Northern Virginia and just watching the actual process. And in just that morning, I did notice that it did take about an hour and a half. And so that was validating for us when we found that. But that most of that time was in the application process, not in the plan choice process. And in fact, one question we did ask our navigators and assisters in the survey was, did you even get to that process, or did you see the plan choice? And much of the time they didn't. So by the time that people got through this whole process of figuring out their income and who was in their household and whether or not they had availability of job-based coverage, and that wasn't very well explained, that this took a lot of time, plus sometimes the website was clunky. And so I think, you know, the plan choice is absolutely important. That's the cherry on top. That's what sort of completes the enrollment. But all this other stuff was what presented a lot of difficulty and required a lot of assistance for people. And that's what the assister program spent a lot of time doing. I think at re-enrollment, we are going to learn in real time what the research literature has told us for a number of years, which is that there's a lot of volatility in the lives of low-income people. Their incomes change, their family status changes, their tax filing status may change. I know assisters struggled a lot when they were helping women who were expecting to get divorced. So today, I think I'm filing jointly, but maybe by the end of the year, that won't be the case. And how do I know? I don't really know. So I think a lot of people are going to be coming in not only to reevaluate their plan choice, but to reevaluate what they're eligible for in terms of assistance. And so we're going to see, I think, a lot more about how much of that goes on. And that is really a very difficult process because there is guesswork involved when you're projecting all of this going forward for another year and then reconciling at the same time what you just did a year ago.
Anybody else? Okay, yes, go right ahead. I should ask the folks who are standing at the microphones to identify themselves, both personally and institutionally, if there is such an identification.
I'm Dr. Caroline Poplin. I'm a primary care physician, and my questions are actually a good follow-up to what you've just been talking about. My questions are for Karen and the follow-up survey that you did. It looks like more than a third of the people thought they picked the wrong plan, and a large number of people were having trouble with the copays and deductibles. So one question is, there was supposed to be a standard form in which the plans were supposed to fill out so that it was easy to compare one plan to another, whereas before this, when you picked an insurance plan, it was 50 pages long, and there was no way to compare one to another because they all talked about different things. And the second question has to do with affordability. I mean, when the subsidies were set up, they were looking at affordability, but also at how much the federal government was going to have to spend, as opposed to how much the people were going to have to spend. And I wondered what your post-enrollment survey told you about either one of those.
We didn't ask specifically about the summary of benefits and coverage. That's the first thing you mentioned, this mm-hmm. standard kind of format that describes in simple terms and no fine print and consistent terms what a plan covers and how it works.
Did you have a sense, though, of whether it was useful?
Well, we're actually in the process at Kaiser now of looking at some of these SBCs, and I know some other groups are trying to do this as well. So, like a lot of things in the first year, they weren't all perfect the first time, and there are inconsistencies, and they're not always, you know, sort of produced in a consistent way. In addition, I think there were kind of technical IT problems with, you know, clicking on the link and it not coming up, or then clicking on the link for the provider directory and that not coming up, or it doesn't match the plan that you thought you were clicking on. So I think many, many factors were at work there to make it, you know, trickier in the first year. And then a lot of these plan designs we're noticing offered through the marketplace are really kind of innovative, creative, new cost-sharing designs. You know, a deductible isn't always a deductible. Sometimes it's a donut hole. Sometimes you get some stuff, and then you hit the deductible, and then you get some more stuff. Sometimes it applies to these services, but it differently to those services. So, I mean, I'm seeing stuff that I've never seen before, and it's kind of interesting to go through and see if we can catalog it. So, I think... For many reasons, it was difficult for people to evaluate plan choices, even if they knew a lot about health insurance coming in. When we asked assisters what kinds of things would you like to have more training on the QHP choices, and in particular, you know, why is it if there's five bronze plans offered by one company, what's different between plans 1 through 5? You know, that's the kind of thing that assisters would like to get more briefing on. They don't want to have to, you know, actually, you know, be part of the sales force of the company to get access to that. They would like to just be able to see it. That should be more transparent. So I think that's one of the things that's definitely still evolving.
Is Kaiser going to do another report before the next open enrollment period?
We do reports every day.
Right, I know. On follow-up of the result, why people didn't like their plans, why more than a third of people thought they chose the wrong plans?
We don't have anything planned on that. We did, just as our assister survey came out, we did another survey on individual market participants, which was more involved. That was a telephone survey. That's on our website as well. And we were looking at people who had coverage that they purchased on and off the exchange, some of the policies that they were renewing, you know, that didn't conform to the ACA rules, as well as new policies. We did have some satisfaction measures. Although, interestingly, on that survey, when we asked people questions like, what is your deductible, we had very high rates of don't know, not sure. So, on and off the marketplace, I think insurance is still a little bit of a mystery to people, more than a little bit. I'm actually working on another thing on insurance literacy, so this is a complicated. It's a complicated feature. Your second question had to do with affordability, and I would defer to my assister colleagues who saw this in real time. But I think, and this is something we asked about in our individual market survey, but the subsidies are not comprehensive in the ACA. People do have to contribute a significant amount of money toward the premium, which is pegged to a level of your income. But the cost sharing, that far surpasses what people will have to pay in premiums in many instances. These are mostly high deductible plans. Even silver and gold plans typically have, you know, $1,000 deductible per person. So that we have a little bit of grade inflation, I think, in our metal tiers. Gold sounds like everything should be covered, but not so much. So there's still a lot of cost sharing that people have to pay for services, and I think a lot of what consumers maybe who weren't used to private insurance were confused about was after they'd paid all this money for a premium and then they went to the doctor and I still owe $150, and that I think that was a difficult thing to understand in addition to a difficult thing to afford.
Lisa, thank you. Jody, any comments?
What I would like to just add is that I think it really depended on where you lived in your community. If you were in a rural area versus an urban area, your choices were far fewer. You may only be choosing from one carrier or a couple of plans from one carrier. And in addition, and certainly in the states where CECO worked, there's a lot of porous borders. So in Maryland, folks are used to going into Delaware, and in Georgia and Tennessee, folks are used to crossing a border. And that got much more difficult this go-round. So I think some of those issues are also really at play because the map is so crisscrossed and you cross a line and the reality is very different.
Jody?
I would answer if I could turn. Okay. I just want to say around affordability, we had to spend a significant amount of time talking about the individual health plans, and we saw a lot of time taken up by that because the consumers didn't come in necessarily being literate around the idea of coinsurance versus a deductible versus a copay, and how many of those things are coming out of their pocket before the insurance kicks in. And when you look at those plans, and I think you mentioned this, so you called it a donut hole, but you really had to tear into the details of the plan with the consumer so that they walked away, they were actually making a decision that they were really well informed about making. And on its surface, the information wasn't necessarily all there at a glance. So I think talking about, when you're talking about affordability, you had to factor in all of those pieces that were actually going to comprise the out-of-pocket piece for the consumer, and not just the premium as one factor to look at. Because if they started adding up some of these other pieces, it was very possible and very likely that it became, certain plans became completely unaffordable. The other issue of affordability we encountered a lot was, the family might have someone who is employed, and that individual who is employed had virtually no premium payments or minimal premium payments, but to enroll the entire family cost $10,000,
right.
But it didn't allow them to enroll in a plan with cost sharing and tax credits. They could only enroll in the marketplace in most circumstances without obtaining those additional discounts. So that was a real challenge we saw a lot around affordability.
All right. Yes, go right ahead.
Margaret McGinty with H&R Block Government Relations. Absent a change or a pushback of the open enrollment date, perhaps Lisa and Jody can talk about it. We're very concerned, and we see a scenario on February 16th. We have our client who comes in to do their taxes, is being somewhat proactive. They're not waiting to the last minute. They did not enroll last season. They're hit with the small penalty for the first year. And then they say, well, how can I fix this on February 16th? And now they can't. They're hit with a penalty that is three times as much for the following tax filing season. What case management issues are you working with, and how are you addressing this with your current enrollees? And what are you using in your advocacy, educating, and essentially marketing plans for those who did not enroll the first time around and took the $95 penalty?
Well, I would say from our perspective, and we saw this a lot towards even the end of the last open enrollment period, that talking about the penalty and the deadlines were real key messages to pushing folks to come in for assistance or to sign up. So I think it's going to be really important that we're really putting an effort forth about getting that message out widely and clearly. I think that we saw that it was impactful last time. It's obviously even more pressing because it's not going to be quite as simple to take the penalty because it will be a lot more painful than it was last time. And it's going to be real important that we're working with a lot of our partners, a lot of the business partners in the community, to make sure they're equally as informed. I think that's going to be really key to getting this information out to folks. And I think working with the partners like, an H&R Block and partners like that who have been helpful in the past when communicating with consumers about coverage issues and have been involved. So I think that's really going to be something we're going to have to spend a lot of time on.
So the emphasis we're taking at CECO in all four of our states is to really take advantage of the time we have now. All of our navigators and assisters are out there doing education, doing outreach, trying to pre-schedule people for enrollment appointments, developing even more extensive referral networks to get people in so that the real focus, I think in the first open enrollment was 6 months, we did both education and outreach and enrollment. And I think the focus really shifted in the last 3 months to just mass enrollment. This time, all the education and outreach, for the most part, is being done front-ended so that we can really take advantage. We share your concern. Again, we found the Vita tax season to be a very beneficial point of contact. And if anyone here is thinking about what might need to happen, some extension of the period
would be wonderful.
Greater overlap with the tax season is significant.
Does that mean, by the way, that there's a any sort of consensus in the community that it would be a good thing to try to align the open enrollment period more closely with the tax season?
Yes.
Okay, there dissent. You go.
I think this is maybe a problem with this whole concept of delivering subsidies through the tax system. And I totally take and agree with all of these concerns that people need to, you know, February, March is when people start gathering their information and they can make a better guess of what they're going to be next year, but they're still guessing what they're going to be next year. I think if we moved the open enrollment to, you know, always end in April, and if everybody always signs up at the end, we run the risk of kind of building a structural quarter of uninsurance into people's lives because their coverage will run out last December, and then they won't sign up again until the spring. And if the answer to that is to realign the plan year, now you've just moved it around the calendar, so now you have to estimate your tax liability for the coming year for 2015 and a quarter into 2016, which I think will be even harder for people. So I think the real problem here is guessing what your eligibility will be a year in advance because the tax system can't give you kind of real-time take on your eligibility. And so I'm a little nervous about proposals to move it around the calendar for fear that we'll uninsure people for several months on a regular basis.
It's a really good point, but you know, people don't focus during the holidays. They, you know, that last December, you know, there was a little bit of a spike to meet the January 1 deadline for folks who had pre-existing conditions, who were really waiting for this opportunity, wanted that coverage on the 1st, but you know, due to weather, due to holidays, it was very difficult to, you know, to fill, especially in our states where we needed to do the large-scale enrollment events. So I think they're all valid points, and I don't speak for the whole community, but there's all sorts of timing factors to take into account.
Jody?
Yeah, I would just say that there's still just the problem, the challenge, I would say, is that there's still a mental disconnect between the concept of having health care coverage and my taxes. And those two don't generally interlink for the average individual. You know, you think of taxes, and that falls in one bucket, and my health and health care access falls in another place. And generally, in people's minds, those two don't interconnect, and we're trying to do that. And somehow, I think that's a challenge that's going to take us a while to overcome for the average person who has to live their everyday life.
Yes, just go ahead.
My name's Brian Balicki. I'm with Technical Frontiers. I have a couple of general questions about the follow-up that's being done with all of the activity in the field. I know you're all doing follow-up. I'm wondering, is this process going to be ongoing as this program continues to be to evolve? And I guess one of the other questions I have, do you have any information about what the beneficiaries themselves, the people who are receiving all this help, are saying about their quality of their experience, whether they're being served by brokers or by assisters or by navigators? Any comments on that?
Could I ask you what you mean by ongoing follow-up?
Well, I guess what I was thinking of, do you do these every year? Do you do them within 3 months following an open enrollment season?
Fair enough.
Well, this was our first survey, so we haven't even decided yet internally. I'm hoping we'll do an annual survey at least for a while because I expect this will be an evolving process at least for a couple of years. But we don't have any immediate plans for surveys. I know my colleague Jen has been out in the field doing a lot of site visits and focus groups to find out what's been going on. So I think we are looking for other ways to constantly monitor what's going on with outreach and enrollment, but we're still figuring this out as well at our foundation.
Before, if I could ask the forbearance of the folks who are at the microphones, excuse me, we don't want to completely diss the people who have written things on cards and we have a couple of tweets as well. Excuse me. So, Jen, I wonder if you could interject at least a couple of these questions. We have about 10 or 12 minutes left.
Okay. So Karen raised this, or began to touch on this issue, and we got a couple of questions related to the training for assisters, and in particular, how adequate it was and what the plans are for improving the training going forward. So I don't know if
our assistant. Jody and I can't speak for the exchange entities. You know, the states dictate their training curriculum in the state-based exchanges, and HHS is currently updating the federal curriculum. C-Code just continues to maintain it as a priority that we will wrap around and do ongoing training with our navigators. They've all been training over the summer. We will train any new employee that's onboarded. We're going to do some mentoring, partnering veteran navigators with newer navigators, and we'll continue to do the quality assurance monitoring to make sure that the folks who are out there are equipped to do the job they need to do.
Okay. And we have a question I would just point you to our survey. We did ask the assisters what kinds of additional training they wanted. 92% said they did want additional training. They found the initial training helpful, but they wanted more training not only at the outset when they get certified, but throughout the year on topics like helping people with their post-enrollment questions and problems, on tax-related issues, on immigration-related issues. They wanted more training in insurance literacy. They wanted a lot more information on the qualified health plans. They also wanted more training on just using the online application and the paper application and how that differs. So, and they said that they very much appreciated training that both marketplaces offered throughout the year, webinars, conference calls, to provide updates and to refresh. And they also appreciated the work of outside groups like Enroll in America and Center on Budget and Policy Priorities. Georgetown University, I know, worked with a number of state programs to provide additional in-depth training on particularly complex topics.
And I would say that one of the things that we hope to see in the training going forward would better, I guess, more directly relate to the kinds of priorities that consumers have when they're trying to select plans. It's one thing to walk through the plan choices and key terminology, but when consumers are actually sitting there and they're making plan decisions, they're really focused on how they will use health care. And that's really key to their very often their decision. It's not solely around cost. A lot of them need health care for particular services. Not all the health plans cover the same things. They need particular providers. They need particular prescriptions. So you really have to be able to get into the nitty-gritty of what the health plans provide and really take the time to understand what the consumer's healthcare needs are going to be so that they make a plan choice that will effectively provide for them access to the care that they're really going to need after they get it covered.
And from the agent and broker perspective, agents and brokers, in addition to their exchange training, are required by state law to complete extensive additional continuing education each year. And they're really the only entity that can truly advise a person about which plan to pick. And so I think that this need for additional training is great for the assister community, but another way to address this, too, is to further encourage better partnerships between the assister community and the agent and broker community, given their extensive plan knowledge and then also the focus of agents and brokers to provide service throughout the plan year. And there's no funding issues with that relative to agents and brokers. So they're in place and they're ready to help. And so if we could, I think, further the partnerships between the two, we could really help provide better information to the consumers, better plan selection advice, and then also better support to the assister community.
And actually, just one little tiny thing. The state of Illinois, they were a partnership marketplace, and they put together a new plan comparison tool for consumers that's based on what a lot of you may be familiar with, because Consumer Checkbook does this, and they do a lot of the plan comparison tools for federal employees and their health plans. And you can go look at that site, but it has a lot more information about plans. And as Jody was saying, not just the cost of the premium, but different kinds of scenarios, if you are a low-cost person, if you're going to have a baby and so forth, more satisfaction information, more quality information about the doctors who are in the network. So I would commend you to take a look at the Illinois Marketplace plan comparison tool. It's kind of interesting.
Very good. Okay. Could I ask folks, as we go through these last few minutes of questions, to pull out the blue evaluation form and fill it out so that we can get the feedback that you want? We're particularly interested in the opinions of those of you who are on congressional staffs, of course. Yes, go right ahead. You've been very patient.
Hi. Thanks for everybody for sharing your expertise. I'm Casey Corbo with Deloitte Center for Health Solutions. I was just interested, given there is a proposed rule from CMS to auto-enroll people, I know that was talked about earlier in the panel. Just curious if anybody, I guess Jody or Lisa, if there are any plans to segment marketing or outreach to folks who have been enrolled or who may auto-re-enroll versus people who may be newcomers into the system?
Sorry. Yes, we're certainly going to have to focus on the renewal and recertification process as part of our outreach and education efforts. And I say that because years of experience of doing this, we've tend to see it's high rates. Retention becomes a challenge, and we certainly don't want folks losing coverage. We don't want consumers, getting confused and making decisions that they're not happy with. So we're really going to have to, and we're doing this now, even as we're still doing special enrollment periods, and consumers are coming in the door. And we're getting out into the community. We're using that opportunity to make sure that people are fully aware that this is going to happen, that they're going to have to take steps one way or another, that this is going to involve them actively in some way, so that they're not caught by surprise, that they know where to get help if they have questions. So we're really taking a lot of time to focus on that, so that people have sort of a heads up that this is coming down the pike and that we're able to keep the enrollment gains that we were able to do during the first open enrollment period.
But it's important to understand that we're not in control of the renewal process. We are not the ones noticing consumers. And there's been a lot of talk about our ability to follow up. If you're operating in a federal exchange state, I can't follow up. I was not allowed to keep identifiable information. I had to get consent to be able to follow up with a consumer through enrollment and only for the purposes of enrollment. So there's no cold calling, there's no knocking on doors, there's no lists. So it is our relationships in the community and people seeing our partners as a trusted source that they're coming in with their letters. And I think it's also important to understand, I guess it's my understanding at this point, that folks will get a notice from the insurance company which will have the full cost 100% of what the plan was, and if they received a subsidy, they then get a second letter with the amount of the subsidy from the government. So imagine having this low health literacy, and maybe one letter comes first, and maybe one is a little bit delayed in the mail, and you can imagine the heart attack you have at your kitchen table. So those are all challenges that are very real and beyond the control of the navigator entities.
And I just wanted to point out that a key difference between the assisters and the navigators and the broker community, because, again, brokers have been around for a really long time and were regulated a little bit differently. So brokers actually could keep that information, and they do have their existing client base that they've been helping all year round. So they are able to reach out to existing clients, and that's why a partnership can be very beneficial, because Lisa can help them and then refer them to a broker to finish up the process, and then that person has the year-round support and then the year-round support with their enrollment. So when they get the two conflicting letters and she doesn't know how to get back in touch with them to say, hey, were you confused? Our members can. and they can help them work out that process. Unfortunately, not everyone had that benefit, and so we are concerned about the year ahead with the redetermination process to make sure, because as Karen pointed out, it's a really volatile population, and their life choices could have changed, their income and what have you, and we want to make sure that they understand those letters and even that they're just looking at the coverage options and making sure that it's the right fit for them.
We have three folks who were standing at the microphone. Actually, we have one substitute who is now standing at the microphone for somebody else, but that's okay. We'll try to get to you. I'm sorry, the gentleman behind the gentleman at the microphone is not going to be able to get his question asked. But I would ask you to keep your questions as brief as possible, and I know our panelists will be as insightful as quickly as possible. And we'll try to get through, even if it takes us in World Cup terms, into extra time. I guess, yes, sir, you were here.
So, hi, my name is Vedat Sripathi from Senator Gillibrand's office. So the data that was presented kind of indicates that there's a lack of coordination among these assister groups. So is there going to be some type of federal or third-party coordination to incentivize, like, further dialogue between these assister groups, or is it just purely a recommendation?
I'm going to take a little difference with that comment. I think especially in the federal states, we had no choice but to coordinate, and we just did it ourselves. In Georgia and Tennessee, we were in regular communication with state associations of qualified health centers, with Enroll America, with the other funded entities who are either sponsoring CACs or had federal resources, because we had to. And we made sure that we weren't duplicating efforts and that we were supporting each other's events and making sure that there was extensive coverage. Now, in Maryland, the state broke it out into geographic regions, and so one entity was responsible for a territory and the partnership and network within that territory, but was very, very well coordinated. And in New York, I think, was probably the most interesting scenario in that there was 22 entities funded to provide navigator services in New York City alone. So there was a little bit of stepping over each other's foot. But that said, there were weekly calls, there were other forms and formats. So, while it may not have, there was coordination, it was more informal. And while that is different, it is not less valuable. And I think that is just an important statement to put out there.
And I would just say in Florida, and just, representing the University of South Florida Initiative, we actually had some more formalized efforts around coordination because, there was a limit to what the navigators could do and how many navigators were on the ground. And in a state as big as Florida, 100 navigators are only going to go so far. And so in a given area, for example, like the Tampa Bay area, which was one of our largest regions, they regularly brought together all the assisters on a regular basis in a coalition format, and they tracked the efforts of where they were reaching consumers, and they also coordinated efforts to get in and get out doing outreach and education events, because one man can't do it all, and so in an effort to make sure that nothing was left uncovered, they worked with the entire scope of assister partners that were in the given area, including the contracted partners as well. And so I would say they were all brought to the table. So that's a good example where, not only did they coordinate, but they actually tracked the efforts of the coordination in a formalized way.
Yes. Hi, my name is Maria Abrika. I'm with the Deloitte Center for Health Solutions. And my question was relating to the Young Invisibles outreach. I guess my question is more, what did you guys learn when outreaching to this specific population? What were your challenges? And the other one is based on some of the studies that you have done, if you've collected information. Did you find any data on maybe the rate at which they outreach to you guys, the sister programs versus other demographics?
Well, I can answer the question about the outreach, and it was interesting. Because we're a university, it made sense that we were reaching out to the Young Invincible population first and foremost. And so we really worked with the universities and the local colleges, the community colleges. We started realizing that some of those mass enrollment events are actually most effective to getting some of the younger population, specifically to those that were enrolled in and obviously into classes. So we worked with student health services and we worked with the student government folks, and this was effective in that we were able to get a lot of students into coverage. I think one of the challenges that we had with that is if you had students at part-time jobs and were otherwise supported on student loans, obviously they were at risk of not being qualified for cost-sharing and tax credits because they didn't have enough income to qualify. In some counties, we were able to connect them to county health plans and make sure they didn't remain uninsured, but in a lot of cases, they were having to, not get enrolled. But I think we found that it was tough starting up, but we were able to use some of those avenues to get to larger numbers of students and that were in that 18, 19 to 34 range, and they're all over the university and they're enrolled in classes and they work part time and they work full time, and it gave us access to a large number of folks, and we utilized those all over the state. So that was effective for us.
Yes. Go ahead. Quick comment.
We found in all four of our states that about 25% of the people we assisted fell into the age range of young invincible, so on par with the national.
Okay. And the last question.
Hi. I'll keep this brief. My name is Michael Fulginetti from the American Institutes for Research, and my question's for Jody. Were there particular interventions that Florida took that were better than other interventions, especially because resources were strict because Medicaid was not expanded?
I'm not sure what you mean by interventions. You mean outreach approaches?
Yeah, approaches, enrollment, and to take certain approaches over others, especially with the low resources.
Well, we definitely found that partnering with the hospitals was effective. That's an easy way to identify the uninsured. So our enrollment with the hospitals was definitely very effective. Now we coordinated with health planning councils throughout the state, and that also allowed us access to a wide range of partners. And we saw the results from that. But I think there were certain aspects of each of their initiatives that were specific to their community. I think the partnership with the hospitals and the college and the universities were very effective. The other thing is recognizing that we did have that Medicaid gap, knowing where the county health plans existed, so we were able to connect people in certain counties to some coverage if they fell in that gap, as well as we put together an actual concrete resource manual of where all the resources were in the community so that folks had access to services that they needed despite not having coverage. So that meant working with the rural health centers and the federal qualified health centers and working with the county health plans and, mental health centers and all of those kinds of resources so that we were still connecting folks directly to services.
Okay, thank you. And how about approaches that weren't successful? Sorry to put you on the spot.
I'm not sure I can answer that question quickly. I think going back to the work with the universities, I think it took us a while to get that off the ground, and initially how we designed those efforts were not initially successful, and we certainly had to circle back and figure out how to make those effective, and which were the right partners to work with in a university system or a community college that connected us better to more students. We initially started off, we saw a very small response to what we were doing. So we were able to revise that and change who we worked with within the colleges. So I don't know, maybe that's more specific.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm. Jen?
Yes. Well, thank you. Thank you
panelists for a wonderful discussion. I think we learned a lot about what worked and what didn't during the open enrollment period this first year. And I think we have some talked about some ideas for improving the process and going forward, but we also know that I think there are a lot of challenges that lie ahead for this next open enrollment period and beyond. But I think this has been a great discussion, and I thank you all for attending, and I thank our panelists for participating.
And ask you to join us in doing so.
Yes.
The sound, the silent. Silently.